definitely black communities were moved to, I mean, I think again, the Cape Town's a great example, moved to the Cape Flats, where it was flat, the land is not as good for growing, and it is more exposed to the harsh conditions, environmental conditions. So the government has incentives internationally placed on it, particularly to transfer, to move away from coal and to have the just energy transition. And so, you know, and funds, I guess, I mean, it's difficult to see where those funds have come or where they're going, but international funds coming in associated with that, moving away from heavy coal use. So there's this external pressure. But internally, environmental climate change issues are not an electoral issue. South Africans don't generally vote along, you know, Green Party lines. It's a very minor issue. It may change in the future, but that's certainly not an electoral issue now for change. Because essentially what these movements and organizations are saying is, treat us with dignity and treat us the same as you would any wealthier neighborhood. And so what does that mean? Like, if you translate that, you don't have to use the word mitigate climate change. What that means is, let's have some green spaces. Let's ensure that the brunt of climate impacts, like floods, heating, you know, overheating, that kind of thing, is mitigated by the support of the state.
Greetings and welcome to episode one of Climate Comms, the podcast. My name is Goke Sosachane, host of this episode. For our first podcast, we are going to be delving into the topic climate change and spatial apartheid. The large majority of South Africans continue to bear the brunt of the legacy of apartheid in many forms. As we are confronted with the impact of climate change, the question we are looking to explore is how the legacy of apartheid spatial planning contributes to who is affected by the impact of climate change, how they're affected, and also the need for us to explore the role of government, government policy, and how it mitigates against the impact of climate change, and most importantly, of course, what is the lived experience of the large majority of South Africans who continue to bear the brunt of spatial apartheid and also confronted with climate change. Our guest is Professor Fiona Asiano, Research Head at the Politics and Urban Governance Research Group. Prof, thank you very much for making time to be with us. I hope you're well.
Thank you. Yes, I'm doing very well. And thanks for inviting me on the show.
A rather important, also painful conversation to be had. Around not only the history of our country, but also how it contributes and the impact and the consequences of the history of our country contributes to today, the lived experience of South Africans today, and then, of course, the ever-looming threat and presence of climate change. Maybe to start, one would not want to assume that there is clarity of what we mean when we speak of apartheid spatial planning and also the continued consequences of it today. Maybe a quick historical context around what is apartheid spatial planning.
Yeah, so that's a good place to start. And I think it's important because the ways in which our country and our cities in particular have been configured and constructed spatially is deeply consequential based on Group Areas Act and the ways in which races were segregated. So I have to say a caveat that I am an urban studies specialist, so I will focus more on the cities and the ways our cities are structured. But essentially, we know that in the 1950s, under apartheid, there was a Group Areas Act which segregated based on your race. And black people, and when I say black, I'm talking here generally to include all Indian, coloured, black African people were moved into different areas and were not allowed to live essentially near the main cities where as a Marxist would call it, the means of production take place, where work was happening. And so this caused huge consequences for the ways in which our transport works, for the ways in which people have to navigate cities and where they were allowed to build and set up homes. And that's what happened in the cities. If we do extrapolate that, obviously we know there were homelands and Bantustans, same consequence. You had migration and people were not able to work where they lived and live where they worked. And that means that you now have cities, and I'm sitting in Cape Town right now, where you don't have integrated spaces, firstly. So that is just primarily a social issue to even start off with. But from an environmental perspective, you have enclaves where people have far fewer resources and are living in spaces that don't have natural resources either. Trees, you've got, you know, the Cape Flats, if we use Cape Town as an example, informal settlements, which are really, you know, not green spaces at all. And then you've got the wealthy leafy suburbs, and they're called the leafy suburbs for a reason, because if we think of Johannesburg, Johannesburg is in the leafy suburbs, you know, in man-made forest, and actually a wonder of the world, really. It's quite incredible. And yet that is a deeply racially segregated, even to today, spaces because of apartheid spatial planning.
Is there any connection at all in terms of the areas where people were placed? Is there any connection to the area, connection between the area itself and whether or not that particular area is prone to specific, whether it's natural disasters or any environmental related impact that those particular areas would have as a conscious decision made by the apartheid regime, if at all?
I don't know that one could trace it that clearly, because I you know, I think in the 50s and the 60s and the 40s and 70s, there weren't, you know, environmental EIA and analysis the way you would have now. So I doubt that the apartheid state was particularly aware deliberately of environmental concerns. It really wasn't on the radar in those days as much as it is now. However, that said, non-white or black racial groups would definitely not have been moved to the best landscape areas. So the arable land, the most protected, the most beautiful parts of our country, particularly here again, I'm thinking of the cities, you know, those areas that had a lot of natural resources, whether, you know, again, Cape Town, the sea views, the mountain, they were demarcated where you couldn't live if you were black. So yes, I think implicitly there was a favoring of keeping the good land, the arable land, the beautiful land, the green land for the white communities. And definitely black communities were moved to, I mean, I think again, the Cape Town's a great example, moved to the Cape Flats where it was flat, the land is not as good for growing, and it is more exposed to the harsh conditions, environmental conditions.
There's also the question of infrastructure. And we can talk about where things are now, and we have to talk about the role of government when it comes to addressing the issue of apartheid spatial planning. But when it comes to the infrastructure that lived side by side with where people lived, maybe a quick picture as to what that looked like and how, if at all today, we're still living with that legacy, because that ties also into the impact of climate change.
Absolutely. I'm going to answer that with an example of thinking about toilets. I do a lot of research on sanitation, and it's very interesting to understand who has plumbed sewered toilets and who doesn't. And the way a colonial city was set up, and our cities are colonial cities in many ways, was that the center of the city would be where you had the best infrastructure, the best gridded networked cities, where, you know, the power lines, the sewer lines, the water lines were all well constructed, well built, and then designed to service a population, a white population in that center area. As the peripheries of the cities grew, and as Group Areas Act forced black communities to the peripheries, to the edges, the infrastructure wasn't nearly as good. And here, if we just look at what happens when you think of sewer toilets. So if you don't put sewer lines that are well built, people can't plumb into sewer lines. So how then do you go to the toilet? And that's why you now have in informal settlements in Cape Town, it's actually a really an issue of land tenure, where you have people who've moved onto land that was not designed to be occupied and set up by the state, primarily the apartheid state, but now even the current state can't and doesn't extend the sewer lines sufficiently into peripheral areas. So that is, that means you now literally have people who are not living with, where they can actually flush their waste away. They have to use container-based toilets that are difficult to access. And this I'm talking particularly if we think of informal settlements. Difficult to access, shared, if you're lucky enough to get a portable flush toilet in your own shack, you then have to live next to your waste. And where do you put that? You know, you've got to wait 2 or 3 days before it can get collected and taken to a treatment center. And so I think, you know, just the colonial infrastructure was not designed deliberately to be able to service large and increasing Black communities. And it certainly at the time wasn't designed to service the size and populations we now have in our cities today as well. So we do have an infrastructure problem. It is a consequence of spatial planning, but not just that. It's also a consequence of now not having had 30 years of maintenance of our infrastructure.
And I'm glad you're going there because, I mean, it's one thing for us to talk about and acknowledge the legacy of apartheid and apartheid spatial planning, but there has been 30 years where what was supposed to happen, or maybe happening gradually, is addressing those infrastructural related issues or many other or undoing what apartheid spatial planning had done. In your work in looking at urban areas and cities, what has been the result of government's work in redressing the legacy of apartheid, specifically to spatial planning?
I think, you know, there's not a straightforward answer. It's quite a mixed answer. I do think we have to stand back and say that under the ANC government, there has been remarkable delivery, if you think of it as a global scale. So if we stand back and we don't, the South Africans are quite parochial, right? We love our country. We think we're quite special and we're quite exceptional in our way we look at ourselves. And so, you know, I work with a lot of informal settlement communities and people are very angry about the lack of services. And that is valid and true. And the services are not dignified enough. But I'm always struck when I travel and do comparative research, which I've been, you know, fortunate to do around different cities in Africa and as well as South America, and go, actually, you know, our governments, the ANC is one of the very few governments in the world that rolled out a housing program to the scale that it did, and that gives free basic water and free basic electricity. That's very, very rare. And in our case, free basic sanitation as well. So that is even more rare. I mean, you will not find, it's very interesting if you go to somewhere like Nairobi in Kenya, the idea that the state provides toilets to informal settlements is mind-bending in the context of Namibia, of Nairobi and Kenya, and that is just not a function people see the state should having, you know, that the state would do. So I think there is a lot to recognize and acknowledge the 30 years of government of the ANC. It is a social democratic government in the sense that it has tried to focus on communities that needed redress, that, you know, Black communities that needed to have better infrastructure. So I think we have to hold that there. However, the scale of having to deal with apartheid redress and to just provide bulk infrastructure to a growing and rapidly urbanizing population has just been beyond what the state has been able to deliver to the standards that match what white communities had during apartheid. So what you're seeing is a deep sense of frustration where people are saying, well, hang on, you know, if I was living in a wealthy white, historically white area, I would have better electricity, water and sanitation. Why don't I have it here? And, you know, the rhetoric is, it's easy to say there's still racism, but I don't think that is necessarily true. I think it's that there's really good infrastructure geared to service relatively low density suburbs and neighborhoods that were historically white and are largely, I suppose, in many places still white because a property price, you know, all the structural factors that have made these neighborhoods haven't integrated. It doesn't mean, I think, that there hasn't been a concerted effort to try to improve infrastructure and servicing in peripheral Black areas, in historically Black areas where those group areas act. area, you know, people move to. The state, however, I do think the one thing that the ANC has not done strategically has gone, we need to allocate money to basic bulk services infrastructure. We need to upgrade and keep our treatment plants going. And we are seeing that now with all the problems with water. And South Africa, you know, it's wonderful when you travel because we are a country where you can drink the tap water and that we just take it for granted. It's always been that way. In many places, you can't. And I think, you know, when that starts to happen, that we can't drink our tap water, that is going to be a step change to say, did the first 30 years of government not prioritize some of the key areas it needed to? We see it with Eskom. It's very obvious when the lights go out. We know what's happened with Eskom. It's less obvious because it's more of a municipal function, water services. But it's happening too at that level, at the municipal level in our water services.
We've set the tone in the legacy, the historical legacy, and then of course acknowledging where there's been gains and also the challenges with post 94 and where we are now, 31 years of our democracy. What is looming and what is a constant threat, and we're living the consequences of it, is climate change. What have you noted in your work around cities in particular as to how South African cities have been impacted by climate change, before we speak to how then has government responded, have we as a people responded, but what has been the impact, what is the lived experience of South Africans in urban areas dealing with the impact of climate change?
Yeah, again, a really good question, and not that straightforward to answer. So my caveat will also be that I'm a political scientist, not a geographer. So I can't give you the nuanced details about climate change. But I think we can see that there are multiple, what I would call shocks to the system that we have to think about in cities. And these are around things like heat, fires, floods, water, and we know that our cities are getting hotter. It's a global trend. You know, that's indisputable, that this is a warming planet and it's warming. And we know that South Africa is not immune to that. I mean, just out of interest, that Africa actually, if you think of some of the equatorial area, Africa as a continent is more vulnerable to climate change and heating than other continents. Because my wonderful colleague, Tina Kulbeck-Fatty, who's an expert geographer, was explaining this to me, that Africa has more land mass that is covered by equatorial regions. And therefore, there is more land that gets hotter by direct heating of the sun. So when global temperatures go up, if, you know, what is the impact on the, particularly not as much South Africa, because we're right at the bottom, but the central part of Africa is doubled. So if it's a 2% increase, it's felt as a 4% increase on the majority of the African landmass. And I say that because I think that was news to me. I did not actually realize that. And I think what we have to then hold in mind is that what is the consequence of that when people, our neighbors, are no longer able to live in the areas that they're used to living in? So we have to think about long-term consequences of migration, etc. And then coming back to South Africa, So it's not a straightforward line. So the impact of climate change may not be directly felt in the city or the neighborhood in which you're currently living, but the consequences will be indirect with things like more migration, and with then the changing weather patterns. And we are seeing, you know, KZN, I don't know what they did wrong in the last few years, but their weather patterns have been incredibly punishing with the ongoing floods. And one could say there's a direct link to climate change there, but I'd leave that to experts. I think you've also got to take into account urbanization and climate change as well, because the more people are moving into the cities, the less you're able to have infrastructure. And now I'm talking about green infrastructure, natural trees, not man-built, that is protecting the landscape, that is protecting, that's protecting our, the creating a heat barrier, for example. So yes, it is becoming more precarious to live in cities. And then we have to also look, you know, there are questions. I mean, obviously Cape Town went through its day zero. Well, we didn't actually hit day zero, but almost day zero. And, you know, there it was linked directly to climate, in that we just did not have the rainfall that, you know, had been expected or predicted over years. As not, I'm not a geographer again, so I can't say whether there was or not direct link, but to me, if you look at what's happening, at the challenges we face in our cities, and you think about climate change on a global scale, there is quite clearly an impact.
I want to stay with government a bit, because again, there is policies that have been put in place. I mean, we know about the Climate Change Act. There's certain commitments that government has made, whether it's on a national, provincial, or local government level. And when you speak of the situation in KZN, which is of course an example of what is happening in many parts of the country, where whether we're talking droughts or heavy floods, there is the question of infrastructure that comes in, allocation of resources when it comes to infrastructure. There is, on the one hand, the allocation of resources, but also the maintenance of resources, and how that, of course, ties into whether municipalities in particular are able to deal with and mitigate against the impacts of climate change or adverse weather conditions that are happening at a frequent rate. What is your take on the state of municipalities, the functionality of municipalities, the resourcing of municipalities?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, right? So, you know, you've got a national level, and that South Africa has these three spheres of government, our national, our provincial, and our local. And the first place to always start is to look at, I love looking at the constitution, because literally tells you exactly, if you wonder whether the municipality or the national government is responsible for something, whether it's getting an ambulance or a house, you can just go to the back of the constitution and it'll tell you, literally lays out. So that's where the complicated line comes in, because the municipalities are responsible for providing water, and oftentimes for providing electricity and for providing sanitation. But none of these things, and then for disaster management as well. So for dealing with floods, fires, etc. But none of these can be dealt with on their own. Just they're not bounded units. They have to work very closely with national and provincial government. Starting off with the treasury and the financial flows, and working out what their grant's going to be every year, and then through the budget process, how much are they going to get to be able to deal with these resources, these challenges? What resources are they going to get? So municipalities are in many ways beholden to having a good relationship with national and provincial governments. I think that's just important to bear that in mind. I think the ability of different municipalities to deal with impacts of climate change are vastly dependent on their own internal strength and their own tax base. So let's look at Johannesburg and Cape Town as two examples. Both of these cities have pretty good tax bases, right? They should both be able to be dealing with infrastructural challenges. And yet Cape Town is doing a much better job. Just evidently, if you drive on the roads, anyone who's traveled, and I'm sure you've traveled Kakezo between Johannesburg and Cape Town, you can just see like there is just better infrastructural provision, not everywhere, but in most places most of the time, than Johannesburg. And that really then comes down to how are these cities being managed and who's taking responsibility for what? And I think that's where we have to look at the internal administration of municipalities as well. It becomes even more notable when you go to smaller municipalities. And, okay, this is now a difficult conversation to have, because it's difficult to get firm data on it. But from a lot of engagements I've done with not all small municipalities, but with certain people in municipalities, there really are systems of nepotism and employment. There is a skills kind of shortage is the wrong word. There is a lack of experience in many of these municipalities. And there is oftentimes a sense that, you know, the resources of the municipality are there to be distributed amongst those who have power in the municipality. So the consequence of that is that services are not being delivered and upheld in the way they should be. And you're not having a skills transfer around how to do basic maintenance and how to manage budgets. And I'm very careful about being pejorative around this. I don't like using the words like corruption, because I think they have a very strong sense of this is good and this is bad and you're bad. And honestly, if you go to any municipality and you ask someone, are you corrupt? They're going to say no. Of course they're going to say no, because what their perception of what corruption is going to be very different. So that's why I find this, you know, it's not a straightforward conversation. But what I would say is that there are patterns of governance that have come into municipalities that have meant that resources and fiscal transfers are not being used in the way that they were intended. And these are often in the municipalities that have almost no tax base themselves. So they're the places where they're not even getting revenue from their rates. So it's a compound impact and a compound effect. So yeah, that's why I say that it's not a one-size-fits-all answer in terms of the strength of municipalities, but there are multiple factors to take into account.
The allocation of resources, of course, you know, it brings up the state of the South African economy and, you know, revenue. And I'm reminded of a recent report of how the Department of Environmental Affairs had asked Treasury for about 704 million rand in order for them to respond to the Climate Change Act. And unfortunately, Treasury was only able to accommodate or allocate 10 million rand, but specifically for G20 related events. Now, what it brings up, and I would like for you to maybe speak to this, because on the one hand, there are the fiscal constraints that we have, but at the same time, we're making certain commitments in terms of our role as a country, how we adapt to climate change, the commitments that we've made to the Paris Agreement, the just energy transition. There's quite a lot of commitments that we have made that and bills are being passed in order to respond to those, in order to have certain policies in place as a country. But all of that happening side by side with the constraints that we have as a country in terms of the economy. And then there's also political will in all of that, right? How do you then make sense of this particular conundrum that we're in and the opportunities that exist, if at all? Because the reality is that we're going to continue to bear the brunt of and the impact of climate change. And going specific, whether we're talking urban areas or even rural areas, infrastructure issues that still remain, the allocation of resources that we've discussed, whether it's on a tax base level or Treasury providing municipalities with their resources, something must happen.
So, you know, I think the environment, the idea of environment, just transitions, is an interesting political question, because in Europe, environmental politics is a political issue. It's a voting issue. You will see people, and to some extent in the US, you will see people voting based on wanting a kind of climate-friendly government. In South Africa, the government has incentives internationally placed on it, particularly to to move away from coal and to have the just energy transition. And funds, I guess. I mean, it's difficult to see where those funds have come or where they're going, but international funds coming in associated with that, moving away from heavy coal use. So there's this external pressure. But internally, environmental climate change issues are not an electoral issue. South Africans don't genuinely vote along, you know, Green Party lines. It's a very minor issue. It may change in the future, but that's certainly not an electoral issue now. So, you know, I think you find the government in the slight pincer movement, and that it's got this external pressure with potential funds. And, you know, we are a government that has been demonstrating to some extent good human rights practice in some ways, you know, at least against the Trump administration. We can be proud of some of our values. So I do think there is a value base there as well that says, no, we should be looking after our environment and thinking of the consequences of that. But there's absolutely no incentive from the local voting base to to have green transition processes. In fact, it's sort of the other way around in many ways. It's like, why would you be spending time and money on the environment? That's not important. Give us houses. We need electricity. We need jobs, you know, and we need safety. Those are voting issues. So you can see that's maybe where the challenge comes in terms of the resource allocation. But I think what has happened that has potential benefits is that because of the external pressure, there is what is now in South Africa called the just urban transition in one hand, or the just energy transition. So the just energy transition is now related to just urban transitions. And we know the just energy transition is how to support particularly communities where you're moving away from coal, and how you support people who've worked in the mines, who've, how do you help ensure they've got employment opportunities, etc. And that's a just energy transition. But municipalities have now been encouraged to focus on a just urban transition. So how do you design and think about your planning of your city that is going to ensure that there is environmental sustainability for the longer term, and how you do that in a just way? And so this is an area that that we've been working in at PUG, but that cities themselves are really grappling with. What does this look like, and what does it mean? And one of the things that we've found is that a simple solution would be, and what has happened in South Africa is a lot of what we call the resource rich or the wealthy or the elites have been able to go off grid to some extent. And nobody ever goes entirely off grid, because you've always got to be networked into the infrastructure if you want electricity and water. So it's a bit of a misnomer, but they kind of go hybrid grid. Solar panels, boreholes, and are therefore... this could be seen as, right, this is leading to a just urban transition now, because now you're using renewable energy and you can reallocate resources to areas that need it, low income areas, etc. Brilliant. But there's an unintended consequence of that our research has shown, in that you are now having, there's a term people are starting to use called climate apartheid. And it's quite a loaded term, and we are thinking carefully about how you use that term. But it's the idea that when the wealthy, and apartheid now doesn't refer to race, it refers to wealth or elite. When the wealthy are able to utilize infrastructure and build their own infrastructure and not depend on the state, they're essentially, there's not a cross-subsidization taking place in the way that you would think it might be happening. You're actually, in the same way we know about the digital divide, uplifting wealthier areas, you can now have an environmental divide where people are actually benefiting more from, not only do they live in nice leafy areas, but now they are able to have more reliable sources of electricity and water, and just have days that work easier, be on the internet, do their work, not have to worry.
I want to link the, and it ties to exactly what you speak of, I want to link the just urban transition to what you touched on, where climate change is not in the forefront of the political agenda, or even election manifestos. And I'm reminded of the work done by the guys from My Vote Counts, where they did the People's Manifesto, where they looked at different issues that are spoken to by different political parties ahead of the most recent national elections, identifying what they say on each issue, including the question of climate change. And it was clear that it is not in the forefront, definitely not for the large majority of parties, some who have gone in great depth in speaking to and being very clear around their policy positions on climate change, and others just mentioning it fleetingly. What that brings up then is, we're going into the local government elections, where one would be looking at what the different political parties are going to be saying, whether it is on the question of climate change, or maybe, if at all, they're going to be speaking to how they would deal with the just urban transition that you mentioned. But considering their different political parties already not having climate change at the forefront in terms of their policy, should we be expecting anything different? And added to that, the idea of just urban transition, as wonderful as it sounds, historically looking at how municipalities have performed, even when it comes to gas emission targets where they have been failing, should we have any faith in the idea of the commitment to the just urban transition?
My short answer would be not as a political issue, no. I would struggle, I may be proved wrong, but I would be very surprised to see the words just urban transition even in any manifesto documents. For two reasons, partly because it's difficult to know what that means, you know. It's a bit of a nebulous term. What are these words, you know? But partly because I don't think South Africa is yet at a place where people are going to see the environment as a voting issue. I still don't think that that's something that the majority of voters, it is going to be a niche party area. You have your green parties, you know, that'll be their area. But I don't see it as being a mainstream party electoral issue. Not in the current climate. And parties have to make choices. And I think, you know, I do want to just go back to clarifying what I was saying about municipalities in terms of how they deal with things like a just urban transition or generally with climate sustainability issues. The difference between Cape Town and Johannesburg is I don't think about how the officials in the municipalities themselves work, how the bureaucrats are working. I think you have good bureaucrats in both municipalities, both trying really hard. The difference I think we see in Cape Town and Johannesburg is the political turnover in Johannesburg has led to such instability that municipality can't roll out a project for very long because they get another political mandate. No, do this. No, do that. And that is the democratic system. I'm a huge Democrat, and I really believe, I'm a huge believer in democracy and the democratic system. And, you know, that's what I mean. But, you know, I think that we still have a strong democracy. You know, let's not make any mistake about this, that the will of the people is still translated into how power works. And I think we should celebrate that. We forget that too often. But sometimes that the way the system is set up, that translates into instability, you know, and that's what we've seen. So I think it's just important to bear that in mind. Cape Town has had the benefit of having a very stable political party in power for a long time.
Apologies. I want to make a shift. Because, yes, of course, we can focus on politics and government. But there's also the role of civil society, right, on the climate justice question as well. What is your take on the role of civil society in these areas, and also, I suppose, broadly looking at cities, then the impact that civil society has on the ground with people outside of governmental responsibilities or responsibilities that government has?
Yeah, so absolutely essential, and I think this is where there may be not explicit demands for environmental policies per se in civil society. And when I mean, civil society is huge, like, right, it can mean a lot of things, you know, but I'm thinking here around largely grassroots based organizations that are driving for dignified, sustainable living conditions. And when you think of that kind of civil society, I was in Khayelitsha yesterday and actually was visiting a community based movement who are, in fact, I think they're protesting today at the city because they're in an informal settlement and they're saying, we need better water, we need better street lighting, we need better communal spaces. So this may not be civil society saying, using the words, we want environmental sustainability or we want you to help mitigate climate impact. Those are not likely to be the terms that you're seeing coming out of grassroots organizations, unless they are particularly, you have organizations that do focus on environment. But generally speaking, but the kinds of demands and calls they're making, I think, can lead to a more sustainable, environmentally sustainable and mitigating the impact of climate change. Because essentially what these movements and organizations are saying is treat us with dignity and treat us the same as you would any wealthier neighborhood. And so what does that mean? Like, if you translate that, you don't have to use the word mitigate climate change. What that means is, let's have some green spaces. Let's ensure that the brunt of climate impacts like floods, heating, you know, overheating, that kind of thing, is mitigated by the support of the state. So if, you know, so if the state or different parts of the state municipalities can deal with improving the livelihood, the living conditions of people, particularly in informal settlements, implicitly they may be dealing with improving the impact of climate change. Because if you can start to deal with sorting out floodplains, I mean, that's where you really have this incredible inequality in the way people are living. To go back to your very first question, we were talking about apartheid spatial inequality, but actually we have contemporary spatial inequality based on where people are living, because they're forced to live on areas that are not safe for habitation, you know, floodplains, steep slopes of mountainsides, because they have nowhere else to go. So they are occupying this land. And if no one chooses to go and live on a floodplain, you and I don't wake up and say, oh, let me go live somewhere that my house is going to be. It's a lack of options, you know. And so then if state support can help deal with that, they implicitly will be helping to deal with the impact of climate change.
Maybe before we conclude, I'd like to also just take the opportunity to hear a bit more for us to understand a bit more about the work that you do at PUG. I mean, we have, you know, drawn from your knowledge and experience, but I think it's also very important to highlight the work that you do. If you could share a bit more about PUG.
Yeah, thank you for asking. So the politics and urban governance, that's PUG's name. we're not really a little dog. So our mandate, our mission is to link policyholders, decision makers, people who have power, to communities that are marginalized and vulnerable and don't have the opportunities necessarily to get their voice heard. So we do that through research excellence. So we're researchers, we are academics, and we work a lot with communities, and we work too with government as well, to really try to think about how can we bring these two decision makers together, not just government, sometimes, you know, other actors too, through research, but not always through mediating voices. So we try a lot to actually, we do things like photo voice exhibitions where we'll work in communities where people will take photographs themselves of their environment. We will facilitate those communities coming to meet with different power holders, and they will talk to each other. And we just hold that space. We just facilitate that space and try to make it a space of engagement. So that's our mission. We have three programs. We have an urban governance program that we've, you know, sort of talks about what we're talking about today, where we work on just urban transitions. What is justice? How do we think about that? We have a democracy and citizenship program, or how do we think about, is South Africa having a crisis of democracy or not, and why, and what does that mean, and how do we improve participation? And then our third program is a human rights program, where we host human rights defenders from across Africa every year, often dealing with environmental challenges. Actually, that's part of what we look for, and we have a human rights summer school, and all of it really ties together. So it's essentially, yeah, trying to use our, and we are very privileged at universities. You know, academics can complain about how hard they work, but the truth is it's a very privileged space, because when you say, I'm a professor, everyone goes, oh, you must know things, and then they listen to you. So our view is, well, let's use that, you know, to try and actually mediate. But we really work as a space to also incubate emerging career researchers. So we're very young. I'm old, but my other colleagues are quite young, enthusiastic, and we have a lot of postdocs and PhD researchers too.
Really amazing. Thank you. Thank you very much. My final question is the history that we come from, that we've spoken to, the challenges, the opportunities, 31 years into democracy. If you were to briefly paint a picture of the lived experience of a young person in the urban, in the cities, confronted by climate change, confronted by just all the challenges in the world. From your research, what does that picture look like?
Yeah, I mean, one of the words that come to mind first is anxiety. I teach 400-500 students every year at university, and I have two teenagers myself. And I think the youth are worried. They're worried because not only do they have to think about, and I think it does, to some extent, it depends where you're living, right, and the kind of resources and opportunities you have. But not only are you worried about, I need to somehow find a job and earn an income, find somewhere to live, you know, where it where it isn't always with my parents until I'm, you know, 45. It's also all of these existential crises. And I think that's where we see the idea of climate change playing a role, in that it's the idea that there are forces beyond your control, that you cannot, it doesn't matter how hard you work or what you do or how much you study, that you can, that you can't impact, you can't change if there's going to be climate challenges. The same way you can't change geopolitics, international politics. And if Trump decides we're going to tariff South Africa to within an inch of its life, and that is going to have an economic impact. And I think that's where I see, when I was growing up, it was, yeah, life is a bit challenging and you've got to work hard. But if I work hard and if I do all these things, I'll be okay. And now I think there's a slight difference of, there's a sense of an external pressure that compounds that. And I do wonder if that's part of sort of the mental health challenges we see so often, where it's a sense of helplessness to some extent. And yet, I don't think that's actually true. I think that we have, you know, I always say this, we have the most incredible youth generation. I love teaching. You know, if I had to give everything up, I would never give up teaching. It's the last thing I'd give up, because I love spending time with young people in their 20s who are bright, who are thinking forward, who are creating solutions, who are doing it. You know, they're there. So as much as I do think there is a sense of pressure, I'm imbued with hope.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Fiona, really. And those young people that are on the receiving end of your teachings are very fortunate. Thank you very much for participating in the first episode of Climate Comms, the podcast. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time.